You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. So, I've interviewed a lot of rock stars in my career, but I think it's fair to say that what we have for you today is something pretty special. I wouldn't say he's the greatest bass player of all time, but he is rumored to be the loudest. Derek Smalls, of the legendary Spinal Tap, who you may remember from This Is Spinal Tap, a movie that he's convinced was a, quote, hatchet job, has his very first solo album, Smalls Change, due on April 13th. This is very real. It is coming. And he is also embarking on a solo tour of the U.S. backed by orchestras. So that is going to be really something, and this is really something. I was lucky enough to sit down with Derek Smalls himself the other day. Well, I was in New York and he was in London, but we were both sitting, and here's what happened. Derek, are you with us?
I'm kind enough to be with you. Yes, I am.
That is very kind of you indeed.
Thank you.
Now, I must say, listening to this album, which I enjoyed very much, I'm also a bit concerned about you.
Uh-oh.
You sound like you're in a dark place. Are you in a dark place? Are you okay?
No, lights are up here. It's good. You mean spiritually, though.
I do.
No, I'm making music, which is the brightest place you can be. I mean, I was in a dark place a few years ago when I was... sitting in Albania, that was a dark place, but now it's great. But, you know, thinking about aging is not necessarily a dark place to be. Everyone you know is either aging or dead. It's just your two choices. So it's not dark when compared to the alternative.
There's a sense on the title track of a diminishment, is what you sing about.
The first... If you're talking about the title track, the first half of it is about diminishment. Like, where did they go? The other people and what was the band? Spinal Tap.
Two shooting stars. I'm in between.
As I say, small change, minor adjustment, no longer a band. They've gone where the dust went. And then, when I realize that, it's the second half of the song is about a new awakening as a solo artist and a bit of bravado, a bit of the old bravado as we lurch forward into the unknown that is the future with this new rock and roll persona, you might say. I did say, but you might say too, and then we both say.
Some people might say that you were the third banana in Spinal Tap. Is that a misperception? Did people misunderstand your role?
There were no bananas in Spinal Tap. There were two apples and one melon, I'd say. The metaphor that I've been linked with in terms of my role in the band was lukewarm water. And I've embraced that. And as, you know, when you get to the point where I am, well, you're now the singer and the leader of a musical ensemble, which includes, I should say, symphony orchestras. We're playing a symphony tour. Strange, but true. You realize the lights are so much brighter at that center mic than they ever were where I was standing. And so lukewarm water is becoming, dare I say it, hot.
Yes, and of course lukewarm water is because you were...
Between fire and ice, yes. Which is the legendary position of I guess, the fates and myth, isn't it? Somewhere.
Now, what happened to the band? The breakups are so hard, but what happened here?
Well, breakups were easy for us because we did it so often. We got good at it. They weren't You know, you hear a lot of bands have a lot of shouting and breakage of crockery, and if there is crockery about things like that. This was a much subtler experience with Tap. You just we'd end a tour or a set of gigs and wait for the next phone call, and it doesn't come, and you call the telephone company and say, you check the line, and they check the line, and it's fine, and then you realize, oh, I get it, we've broken up again. And that's the way it would go. So it was basically like, if you've ever been in a coastal promontory and the fog rolls in, it's like that. It's very much like that. And you just look around and there's nothing there. That's how it feels when Tap would break up. And it, as I say, it did on many an occasion. It was a highly breakable band.
Does it feel final at this point?
I would say that this was probably the best breakup we've ever had in terms of its duration, in terms of its intensity or lack thereof, and in terms of its sense of, if not finality, climaxity, if that's a word.
Sure, and... tell me about your last conversation with David St. Hubbard.
Well, I wouldn't say it was a conversation. We communicate by post because I've had two bouts of therapy for internet addiction, so I don't use the email or the text or anything. And I say, hey, mate, how are you doing? And I'd get back a letter full of Chinese pictograms. And,
I see.
You know, I have no idea what they meant. I don't know if David did. I presume they were from him. They might have been from the dreaded Janine. But anyway, they're attractive. Hung a couple of them up in the kitchen. But no idea what he was saying. If anything, he might have just been saying dumplings, for all I know.
And Nigel, what's the current state of your relationship with him?
We're good. We you know, we're like two different planets that every once in a while get into gravitational orientation with each other, pull a bit, and then drift away again. He's vastly into this world of animal husbandry. He's just besotted with it. Spent years trying to breed miniature horses and then experience the... The disappointment of realizing that he couldn't find jockeys small enough to ride them, and now he's about doing miniature livestock, and charming little things he's breeding. But the goats, which was his last project, are now again he pushes it too far. The goats are too small to milk, so he's avid, but a bit crazed on the subject. But very happy about being surrounded by little animals.
Now, obviously, there's been a revolving lineup of drummers. Was too much made of that, the fact that every drummer in Spinal Tap passed away in some unexpected manner? You know, it's almost become a metaphor in the culture when, for example, in the Trump administration, when jobs change, they say it's like being the drummer in Spinal Tap.
Yes, I've seen that.
Don't people make too big a deal of that, maybe?
No, I don't think they make a big enough deal about it. It was a curse, and curses are not to be sneezed at or even burped at, for that matter. But the interesting thing to me is we had half a dozen or more drummers on the Small Change LP, CD, whatever you want to call it. It's both, and yet neither. And all of them are fine. I mean, so
wow.
Yeah. So, it's a curse that attached, I'm guessing. I know not that much about curses. I mean, a little bit. Attached to the three of us, but not to me. For me, I guess it's almost a reverse curse, because a couple of the drummers said they'd never felt better after they did the session. So,
yeah, when you call a Taylor Hawkins who plays on this record, did he have any trepidation given the horrific fate of so many people who played with you on drums?
You know, they all wanted a nice insurance policy for the wives and kiddies, just to be on the safe side. Some waivers were signed. Some incantations were laid, I'll admit it. But, you know, you want to propitiate the Supreme Evil One before you take on another drummer, any guys. But no, as it turned out, they were all exceedingly relieved and happy to have been a part of the project. And I must say, I mean, Chad, the great Chad Smith, said, if I didn't have this other gig, I'd be drumming with you all the time. Derek makes me feel so good. So there you go.
Chad has a very big personality in my time with him. How did your interaction with him go?
He fills the room. He fills the bloody room. He's a big, tall geezer to start with, and then he uses every inch of it. And I'm talking about his body. And he's just a force of nature, and yet would probably not last 5 minutes in the wild.
Now, on the song Memo to Willie.
Yes. I know what you're going to say. I know what you're going to say, but go ahead, say it. Go ahead, say it. Is it about me? Is it about me? Is that what you're going
to
say?
You know, it hadn't occurred to me to ask such an invasive question, but, and I mean, of course, for the listeners at home, this is about a common affliction of older males, or rather feeling, fearing the advent of such an affliction.
Well, Willie...
A subject you would think would have, yeah.
Willie is British for, you're the male member, of the family, and... you say older, but I've been on tour in America and from time to time, and you turn on the telly and you see all these adverts and these men, you know, could be 30s, 40s, you know, nice looking blokes, and they're out with their girlfriend or their partner or whatever she is, and it looks like they're getting it on, and meantime on the sound. The announcer is blathering away about when you, you know, you want, when it's that time, you want to make sure you're ready, wink, 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 wink. And so you realize a great deal of time and energy and thought and anxiety is devoted to this subject. And, you know, you don't want to take a pill if you don't have to. And so this was a heartfelt cry of the heart to the other end of the body to... get it up and keep it up. A plea for continued tumescence, as it were. A stern talking to is what Willie deserves. A stern talking to.
You have the great Donald Fagen,
yes,
among other guests, on the track delivering vocals. Now, Steely Dan is, you know, epitomizes sophistication and intelligence, and some might say, wow, that is the opposite of Spinal Tap. What is he doing there? So what did you find in common with this seemingly incongruous collaborator?
Well, it's just a lucky set of almost accidents, because the bridge of the song in question is time is a poor excuse, age is but a number. You can still be of use when I'm dead. That's when you can slumber. Give me that lumber. So I'd sung the verse, the bridge, and then my producer said, after give me that lumber, sing Willie Don't Lose That Lumber. And I thought he was kidding, and he was kidding, but I did sing it. And then I turned around and tapped out a little message. I dictated it because I can't get near those machines, those infernal machines, to Donald Fagen, whose address I'd gotten at a club one night, not from him. And I just said, dear Donald, if I may presume, two things, please don't sue me, and would you mind singing on it? And he did. So far, he's... gone along with the first, and certainly he's gone along with the second, so we're at least one for two.
And the album closes with When Men Did Rock, which is, I would say, has an elegiac approach. It's quite epic.
It goes on for 10 minutes. Magical thing about it is it feels much longer.
Do you feel a nostalgia for the age when rock and roll had a bigger place in the culture?
I don't think it's nostalgia necessarily, because nostalgia means that you wish you were there or you wish it were here. I'm fine, but I just it's a fond look back at a moment that occurred that may never occur again, at least in our lifetimes, when rock and roll was about building. It was almost, it had gone out of the three-chord, three-minute song era into the now we are building pyramids of ourselves. A monumental era in rock, and a monumental song to document it, it seemed to deserve. In the same way that in that era, they were doing these monumental songs about the Middle Ages and King Arthur and all that. That now is our, that was our Camelot. We didn't know it at the time. It was our Camelot. It was our Carousel. It was our, all the shows that begin with C's.
You're speaking of prog rock, of course, and this song has Rick Wakeman on it.
And, yes, you know, and Joe Satriani.
And Joe Satriani. We're going to get to him.
A Battle of the Titans in the middle of the song, and Michael League, who we do a bass duet, a duel, all of those at the beginning of the song, just to give you a sense of what you're in for.
Rick Wakeman did a tour with King Arthur on Ice, I believe.
Did he?
And
was Rick on Ice?
So I don't believe he was on Ice, but you know, people give Spinal Tap such a hard time, but here we have King Arthur on Ice. Doesn't that emphasize how people kind of single out Spinal Tap for criticism as being somehow ridiculous?
Well, that goes back to the hatchet job, which is what I call that film about us. Just to give you one example, it's a tour across America. And 91-92% of the time, we found our way to the stage straight away. What does he put in the film? One of the five or six nights we didn't. So he had an agenda, didn't he? And yes. His agenda was to make us a laughing stock, which I think in fairness, he thought would be good for us.
Now, we're going to talk about Joe Satriani. How does he compare to Nigel Tufnel in as far as musicianship, personality, just overall excellence?
I say Joe is less random in his approach. Nigel is probably, in his own way, more spiritual, I'd say. Spiritual in the sense of communing with animals, which of course he's doing now on a regular basis. But even then, I think, as he didn't see, as he was doing his solos, I don't think Nigel saw people in the audience. I think he saw imaginary animals and was playing to enchant them. I don't think Joe does that. I don't know, you'd have to ask him.
But on a technical level, do you think that Joe surpasses Nigel Tufnel?
You're asking me to rate guitarists on the basis of their speed, dexterity, fondness for certain notes. I think Joe's clearly the better technician. Nigel, I think, is the more imaginative artist. I don't think Joe's ever done a solo where he played the guitar with a violin, and Nigel has. Just strummed the chords of the guitar, the strings of the guitar, with a violin. I don't think anyone else has even thought that was a good idea, let alone tried it.
You collaborate with Jane Lynch on a couple songs on this album. She appears on, I won't even say the name of one of them. The other one is, she puts the bitch in Obituary. Now, were you comfortable collaborating
you're on satellite radio and you won't say the name of the song.
You know what? I'll let you say the other one.
It's called Gum in the Gash, mate.
And the subject matter of that one, how would you describe it?
Aging is a matter of things. Age takes things from you and gives things back to you. And so even when you lose some dentition, you're still able to give joy to others.
Now let's talk about Big Bottom, because a couple things. You play in the live version a double bass.
A double necked bass would be the problem.
Double neck bass, yes. Pardon me.
Yeah.
As best as I can tell, you only use one of the necks. So
they're identical. Mm-hmm. So you really don't have to bother with the other one.
So what is the, exactly, so what is the meaning of that? Why do you need that double neck bass?
Just in case one neck goes bad, you've got the other neck.
I see.
It's a spare.
Have you ever had to employ the spare? Has there ever anything gone wrong with one?
I've been incredibly fortunate in my career. I haven't made all the money in the world. I haven't been as famous as a lot of other people, but I've never had the neck go bad on me.
Do you feel that that bass line is one of your finest musical accomplishments? Are you very attached to that one?
I think it's iconic. I think it's iconic without being ironic. Symphony tour that we're doing, I've heard that riff now played by symphony orchestra, and it sounds like something bloody Verdi would have written or something. It's amazing. So I say that in all due lack of modesty about myself, that riff is if this is to be the end of Derek, that riff should be engraved on the stone that would sit on top of what's left of Derek.
That must be quite a feeling to hear this music played by an orchestra. Very validating.
It's freaky. It's freaky, mate. It's freaky. It's you don't realize what you've done until you hear 80 people in tuxedos sawing away at it.
Now, one of your signature compositions, though controversial, in Spinal Tap was Jazz Odyssey.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how that song came together.
Controversial is itself a controversial word to say. Mm. To say it's controversial, to me, inspires controversy. I don't know if that's fair
I
to
see.
Say. But, you know, I happen to agree with it, but there are those who wouldn't, I think.
How did that song come together? Is there any chance you'll be performing it on your upcoming
see,
tour?
There,
what are your feelings
say,
about it now?
When you say that, there are people who, and I've read so-called critics who've said the song never did come together, and that was its essence. That it just
very unfair in some way.
It refused to come together in some way. It was two chords, and yet there was an utter lack of organization and simplicity about it, which was why it was jazz. You know, we did, I think, what will live as the classic version of it on the 2011 Back from the Dead record, which is now deservedly a collector's item. And so it was a 45-minute take cut into three-minute segments, so three cherries off the top of it for your listening pleasure, as it were. I've retired it now. It's been replaced because, to me, as a jazz piece, two chords was one too many. It turns out, people got confused playing it. So I've moved along. That was a jazz excursion, as I called it at the time. I've got a new piece, a jazz incursion called Jazz Iliad, which we may or may not be premiering at the shows. We're still working on it. But it's one chord, and it's when you say come together as a song, nothing comes together as a song more easily than a one chord song. It's really hard to get lost.
Now, a moment that people associate with you was getting stuck in a...
See, there you go again.
Well, I know what to call it.
It was a pod. Many's the night I didn't get stuck in it, in that tour. The night.
What was going through your head while you were...
Get me the bloody fuck out of here is what was going through my head.
Mm. It speaks to your professionalism. I believe that you were continuing to play despite being trapped in a pod.
Thank you.
Perhaps losing oxygen, yeah.
Thank you. That speaks to my professionalism and to the force of habit, both. I would say.
Did you allow those pods to be used afterwards, or was that it for the pods?
It wasn't up to me, mate. It was, group decision. And as the non-guitar player in the band, sometimes I felt a bit under-considered in terms of group opinion. So it was like, Derek, don't be so sensitive. Never happen again. That's once in a lifetime. Don't worry about it. And it to be fair, it didn't happen that often again.
You're the rare rock and roll star to smoke a pipe. I believe I've seen a couple members of Jethro Tull perhaps do it first, but where did that come from, that habit, and have you continued it? Because I think people will be worried about your health on that front.
I stopped putting anything in the pipe, in the bowl, years ago. and it then became just a lovely affectation on my part. And you get into the habit of having something in your hands or something on in your mouth. But no, I've stopped because, you know, the kids look at you, and you want them to you want to model the right behavior for the kids. Not that I have any, but the kids that and of course my audience doesn't have any or isn't kids anymore. But should a kid wander in to the shows, you know, attracted by the idea of a symphony, I want to. I don't want to lead them down the wrong path. You know, it's important for me as a role model to show kids that a Satanist can be a good person.
Another thing that people know about you, which I suppose is a touch embarrassing perhaps, is that you had a zucchini wrapped in tinfoil down your pants, which was caught at airport security.
Mm.
Is it painful for you to know that that was caught on film, or are people missing something about that incident?
I think it was, in fact, an amazing look forward into a future we could never have anticipated, where everyone was going to be embarrassed and humiliated at airport security. You know, everyone is Derek Smalls now, isn't it?
Interesting.
Yeah. As for why I was doing that, it was our biggest tour to date. I was concerned about stage fright or nerves affecting my ability to project the proper puissance, if you will. Ordinarily, I wouldn't be concerned about it. But it was just for that tour. I wanted to make sure, especially with film cameras rolling, that I always maintained the proper stance of power. And unfortunately, this fairly intrusive woman put me in a position of less than powerful. Let's put it that way. But again, I would say to young people listening, don't try to go to airport security with anything wrapped in aluminum foil. That was my mistake. My concern was why it was in foil was if you've ever put a zucchini down your trousers, or a courgette as we call them, without foil wrapping, and you sweat and the tight trousers, you've got a bit of a mess on your hands at the end.
It was an adventurous choice of vegetable. You could have gone with cucumber, but you went with zucchini.
People think it's
think
a lot of people
about your artistic approach.
Thank you. A lot of people mistake it for a cucumber, but of course, a cucumber is larger usually, which is to me it was a bit over the top. And also, if you look carefully, it's a thin foil coating we had on it, and the trousers are skin tight, as we say. So. A cucumber's surface is a bit too warty for the desired effect.
You returned to a version of the Spinal Tap catalog with Gimme Some More Money,
mm-hmm.
sort of a take on one of Tap's
earlier
songs.
Well, I think you know what you ought to be.
What led you back to that territory?
The realization that a band in its infantile stages and in its, or a musician in the infantile stage of a band and a musician in what some would call pre-senility is equally needy in the funds department. And it's become more and more challenging for bands to make money. It's more and more necessary for musicians to say, "Hey, wait a minute! This doesn't fall off a tree, mate. You know, something's got to happen here. Somebody's got to fill the coffers or cough the fillers, whatever." And it just is as urgent now as it was then. Let's put it that way. It's the circle turning on itself. It's the worm eating its own head.
And David Crosby appears in that song. What was
yes,
your
he does.
Time with him like?
Well, you know, first of all, we have virtually the same hair color at this point, so we compared products. But also, he's a curmudgeonly git. And, you know, you've got to spar with him a bit. And I'm not up for that. So I just sit in the corner and let my producer do the sparring with him. But he's a lovely, lovely person. It was great singing on it. And, you know, when you get past the... the curmudgeonly front that he puts up. There's a wonderful, warm, real curmudgeon at the heart of him.
Now, I wanted to touch on a couple of Spinal Tap classics. We discussed Big Bottom.
Mm.
The process was a collaborative process of writing those songs.
Yes, very much so.
With you and Nigel and David. I mean, tell me, just for example, Hellhole. What do you remember about that one coming together?
The wind was 30, the mattress 6. This ain't a place to be a man.
You know, we'd sit in a room and usually come up with concepts. We're a very conceptual band. And so, Hellhole. We'd heard that phrase, hellhole. What does that mean? Where could that be? What could a hellhole be? Where would be the hole? Is it a hole in hell? Is it a hole to hell? We'd have these long discussions. There weren't meetings. They were just, we'd be in a room together, but it didn't feel like a meeting. There was no agenda or anything, and nobody was chairman. And then we'd start. Somebody would shout out a line, and when I say shout out, I don't mean it at volume. I just mean out of the silence. And then other lines would flow, and it was the magic of the flow that was really magical. And then David usually would go home or wherever he went, and come up with some music that matched the lyrics. But it was with us, we were a lyrical band. We were a band about, you know, the word. Tap was words. And the music came as a wonderful cacophony of music surrounding the words.
The brilliance of Big Bottom is, in addition to the bass line and the music, is the sort of confluence of the bass-heavy music and the topic of Big Bottoms. How did that come together in your memory?
It was pretty obvious, mate. A song about Big Bottoms had to have a big bottom, and it was a bit of convincing on my part to Dave and Nige to put the guitars down, pick up the bass, play the nice fat strings instead of the little thin finger shredders, and. But that was the concept from, you know, the minute Big Bottom, you know, it just does that. And so, you know, at that time, you never imagine you're going to be standing on the stage at Live Earth, bloody Live Earth, with 19 of the world's great bass players, including Mr. Trujillo of Metallica, all playing that riff. And how much bigger can a bottom get? Well, we now have a symphony orchestra playing it in the show, and you'll hear how much bigger it can get. The bottom, you know, it sounds like a slogan, but the bottom just gets bigger. Of course, there are people who have personal experience of that too, so it's not that unusual.
In the song "Listen to the Flower People," there's a televised performance in which you mouth "I love you."
We love you.
In the end, were you speaking to all of us?
We love you. I believe.
Pardon me. Yes.
We love you. Well, I was speaking for the band, speaking to all mankind, or other creatures which might have television. At the time, you know, it was such an oceanic consciousness at the time. You didn't limit it to humans. Elephants are spiritual beings. I don't know if they watch telly, but
sure.
A lot of spiritual beings have better things to do than watch telly, but if they just wanted to lay the spiritual thing aside for 3 minutes and watch some telly, there it was for them. A spiritual message.
We
understand. We're on the same wavelength. Mate, we love you. Please love us back. Or sod off.
And the world did love you back, I think. I think that did happen. And
some of them did. Some of them did. Yeah.
Saucy Jack. I think a lot of us were hoping that someday the entire rock musical Saucy Jack would emerge. Instead, we've heard one track.
Yes.
Do you think you guys will ever get to that? And what was the original genesis of that idea?
David and I were sitting around talking about Jack the Ripper. David was fascinated by Jack the Ripper. I was know, mildly interested. I thought there were more interesting serial killers about, but David just couldn't get his mind off of Jack. And come on, Doe, let's write a song. Let's write a musical. And I said, well, Nigel's not that interested in musicals, is he? Yeah, he'll come along. He'll come around. And so it was David's inspiration, really, his obsession, his artistic obsession, you might say. And then I think we realized if there's such a thing as a subject too big for a musical, it really is Jack the Ripper. I mean, I don't know what would be the right art form for maybe ice show, you know, something bigger than a musical. There's never been an ice show about a serial killer, so maybe that's really where it belongs. It's on ice. It is on ice, of course, in the other sense of the word, but maybe to put it on ice would be the... And if David is listening and understands anything besides Chinese pictograms at this point in time, that may be a word to the wise. Put him on ice. Put Jack on ice, mate.
Now, in your journey to this album, there were some low points. You mentioned Albania. What happened there?
Well, it was just, after the last breakup of TAP, after Glastonbury and Wembley, I went over to the Netherlands and had a great run as a judge on this music competition show called Rock Stars with a Z. I was one of the judges, and an incredible woman who was the lead singer of this neo-punk band Hot Garage was the other judge. And we were big especially in the hinterlands of the Netherlands. And then one day they came in and said, well, we're changing the format to Tomorrow's Hip Hop Heroes, also with a Z. And we were out on our behinds. And I had a friend in Albania. He was headquartered in Albania for the tax reasons. Eddie Dregs. It was in a near-death metal band called Chainsaw Vermin. And I'd hung out with him for a few months, and it was just, you know, when the regular bass player just couldn't bother to come in, I'd fill in for him, and I just thought, is this where it all goes, to being fill-in bass player in Chainsaw Vermin? And then so that was a low point. And then I went over to Latvia, and because I'd been working out, I got a part-time gig as a male dancer at a club in Riga called PK Hunkington's, and it was good money, but you had to, you know, fetch it out of your trousers at the end of the night. And so what got me out of that low point was hearing about the British Fund for Aging Rockers, which had been started, I guess, with all the money that they had left over from austerity, and they were looking for aging rockers to help. And I said, here's one right here. And submitted a CV, and before you could say Bob's your uncle, I had the funds to pursue this project, which is, you know, a high point indeed compared to dancing for tips at PK Hunkington's in Latvia.
One of the more admirable aspects of this album is the way that you address subjects that are truly the reality of living as an aging rocker. You probably won't hear on the next Rolling Stones album them singing about MRIs,
mm-hmm,
and erectile dysfunction.
Yes.
And your song about Satan getting a toupee, hell to pay. These are all, it seems like you wanted to do something a bit more real than some of your contemporaries.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah. I think people have concluded that rock and roll is not the place for deep thoughts, and I'm trying to prove them wrong. And you've named three of the thoughts, and it can go deep, and yet be seemingly incredibly not deep, non-deep. But yes, I think write about what's real. Write about what you know. I know a bit about the Supreme Evil One, and I just, you know, because I'd written Christmas with the Devil, which was a speculation about what the merriest time of the year is for Christians, what it's like for the Supreme Evil One. He's not having the greatest time at that moment, at that time of year. And so I find it easy to, for whatever reason, whatever mystical reason, being able to put myself in his shoes, his hot little shoes, and imagine, well, he's getting on, as we all are. Might he be worrying about something receding up top? And if so, what would he do about it? What should he do about it? You know, with, given all the options these days with the drugs and the surgical procedures, which I think is a joke. So that was the roots of that song. And what was the other one you mentioned?
I think we went through the other one.
All right.
But yeah,
right,
so
right.
Yeah,
yes, but MRI. Right, yeah. MRI. Yeah. So there's, you know, it's in everybody's future. It's like, you know, the same way that when you're a kid, the machine that looks at your feet and says what size you are was in your future every month or so. This is in your future now. It's just a matter of time before you're going to be shoved in that tube, hopefully more than once. And so people are scared of it, especially claustrophobes are terrorized by it. And so I take you on a journey through that tube, starting with the fear and ending with the realization, which, you know, comes as, to me, is the good news for all fans, especially of loud and heavy music, which is you can relax. They're banging your head for you.
I wanted to ask you before we go about Brexit as one of our greatest British rock stars. What do you make of that situation?
It's my favorite meal of the day.
And what do you make of, as an outside observer, what do you make of the Trump administration in America?
I think he probably wishes he could grow it longer. And I'm speaking of his hair. And you know, I feel that pull in him, that urge that seems to be driving him. And it's a sad one. It makes me sad for him that he has to, you know, comb it in so many different directions to make it cover whatever it's covering. I wish, you know, for him, more follicles, I guess, would be my wish for him.
And finally, Derek Smalls, how do you want to be remembered? There's so much musing about mortality on this album. So when people look back, what do you want them to say about you?
First of all, I do want to be remembered as Derek Smalls. I mean, how do you want to be remembered? As by my proper name. But for what do I want to be remembered? I'd say, you know, the bass as an instrument in loud music is the foundation stone. It is what this magnificent structure of rock is built on. And I was but a humble laborer in the vineyards of construction of that monument of rock.
And do you have a message for Nigel and David if they're listening?
You said the three words that I would send to them, making the sounds as well as the motions with my mouth at this point. We love you. I think I speak for everyone when I say that. Maybe even myself.
So you've been listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyatt. That was me and the legendary Derek Smalls. We'll be back next week here on Sirius XM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, download us as a podcast, subscribe to us as a podcast, and maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.